we have two speakers, two for the price of one this week. Nicholas Delianu and Edith Ojo, who will be talking to us about fashioning Africa at Brighton Museum. So this is really, they will explain more about it, but it's they're talking about a project at the museum that's been running over the last few years to develop a new collection of African dress, kind of modern African dress from the 1960s. So both Nicola and Edith have been very closely involved with this project on the collecting panel, and they each have kind of complementary but sort of different expertise which they'll be sharing with us. So to give you just a little bit of a background about who they are, Edith is an art consultant based in Brighton. She works with sort of many artists and artist groups across the region. She has previously worked for Arts Council England in Diversity and Arts, as Diversity and Arts Relationship Manager. That's right. And she also has an academic background in African Studies and Fine Arts. And Nicholas Delianu, she currently works at the Museum of Domestic Design and Architecture at Middlesex University, although she's about to start work on a new project at Sussex, looking at African connections in Sussex and Kent museums, decolonial futures for colonial collections. Mm-hmm. Sounds very interesting. And she has for her PhD, she worked on the collection of African textiles at the V&A. So if I can hand over to Nicola and Edith.
Hello, hi. So I'm going to start and then I'm going to hand over. We're going to be passing back and forth a little during the presentation. We don't need those, they can go. So this paper is going to discuss the Fashioning Africa project at Brighton Museum and Art Gallery, which started in 2015, and it's supposed to have finished by now or be finishing now, but it's actually just been extended to March, April next year. We've both been involved in this project, as Zoe was saying, firstly as members of an advisory collecting panel, which we'll explain more about later, and then later we were hired by the museum on a freelance basis to assist with sourcing outfits for the project, and again we'll explain more about that later. So we just want to say that up front so that you know of our personal involvement in the project, and I'd also like to say that this paper is partly based on a forthcoming book chapter we have co-authored with Helen Mears, who is Keeper of World Art at Brighton Museum and who initiated the project we're going to be talking about. She couldn't be with us today, but we have, as I say, this is based on a co-authored thing, so when we attribute thoughts and feelings to Helen, she does know that we do have her permission to do that. Brighton Museum were awarded a grant through the Heritage Lottery-funded Collecting Cultures Strand to create a collection of African fashion from the 1960s onwards. The project is called Fashioning Africa, and these were its aims. So it was to create a collection unique in UK museums reflecting African fashion and design from 1960 until 2000. That's actually been extended to 2008. And ideally, the museum would have liked to extend it further, but it's a condition of the funding that if something is going to be classified as heritage, according to this particular funding strand, it needs to be at least 10 years old, which has created problems for the project. So the collection was designed to bring new meaning and relevance to Royal Pavilion Museums, which is Brighton Museum, outstanding historic collection of African textiles, and to implement new approaches to developing the collection in collaboration with local communities and external specialists. And we're going to be talking mainly about those two aims tonight. So I'll be talking about why it was necessary to create the collection, and then Edith will go on to talk about the collecting panel and the methodology Brighton used to employ to carry out the project. And then we'll talk about some of the things that have actually been collected, and how that process went, and that is something that is ongoing, and like I say, it's supposed to finish, but will be continuing on into next year. And then hopefully at the end as well, Edith will talk to us about putting some of the objects that were collected on display, which is a project she's recently been involved in. Is there still on display?
It's still on display, so still yes. On display.
So, quick plug for various things happening in Brighton for anybody that fancies a trip to the Seaside. So Brighton Museum was founded in 1861 in the upper rooms of the Royal Pavilion. For those who haven't been to Brighton, the Royal Pavilion is a palace built by George IV and then put under the control of the local government by Queen Victoria because she didn't want to maintain it. And although the collection started in the Royal Pavilion, in 1873 it was moved to a purpose-built building across the garden from the pavilion. And that's the building you see there. And from its beginnings, the collection included things from around the world alongside artworks and natural history specimens. And the museum's world art collection today constitutes some 13 or 14,000 objects and images from Africa, Asia, the Pacific and the Americas. The world art collection has been designated as nationally important, with textiles acknowledged as an outstanding strength across the whole collection. More importantly, Royal Pavilion Museum's application for designation of its then ethnography collection makes particular note of African material as the strongest area of the collection, historically having benefited from the donation of material by colonial servicemen retiring from Anglophone Africa. And here you have two highlights from the historic collection. Of African textiles. And while this link to colonial personnel is true for many museums across the United Kingdom, that's how a lot of the stuff came here, the towns of Brighton and Hove in particular expanded very rapidly during the late 19th and early 20th century, becoming a desirable place to live and attracting a large number of retired colonial officials who later gave objects to the local museum. Collecting from Africa tailed off around 1940, and this was a gap that was kind of starkly revealed to the museum when they organised a temporary exhibition called Fashion Cities Africa. And this was on display from during 2016. And this exhibition eschewed the museum's historic holdings to explore contemporary fashion practices in four African cities. So Casablanca from North Africa, Lagos, West, Johannesburg in South Africa, and then Nairobi for East Africa. And the aim of this exhibition was to look very specifically at those cities rather than doing a kind of generalised Africa show, to look very specifically at those cities and then to work with specific individuals or organisations within those cities to tell very specific narratives about certain designers, bloggers, stylists, etc. The exhibition exposed a lacuna between the timeframes represented by the African material in the World Art Collection and the loaned contemporary material, which was the focus of the exhibition, and which included designed garments by Amaka Osakwe of label Maki O, who some of you might have heard of, by Saeed Marouf, Lanre de Silva Ajayi, Deola Sago, and Rich Mincy, amongst others. And as I said, the exhibition was focused on the personal style stories of named individuals, and this further highlighted shortcomings in the historic collection, where objects were asked to represent a people, a region, a nation, or a continent. So this gap in museum collections is not specific to Brighton Museum, and it's a pattern repeated across the country. Extensive ethnographic field collecting came to an end by the middle of the 20th century, due to decolonisation and also new developments in anthropology that did not favour collections of objects in their methodology. And some have characterised this period as well as a period of sort of retreat and forgetting for museums. They were sort of backing away from the colonial history. Decreasing budgets and increasing complexity and expense associated with caring for existing historic collections also means that museums simply can't make the kind of large-scale acquisitions that occurred in the early 20th century. nor would it be ethical to do so. While many museums have acquired a few pieces in an ad hoc way through donations, an informal survey undertaken by Helen Mears while applying for this funding revealed that no efforts were being made to collect strategically in this area. And while African dress from the colonial period was well represented, there was very little across the country post-independence. Where active collection has been undertaken, it has tended to focus on flat printed textiles, kangas and Ghanaian printed cloth at the British Museum, Malawian kitenge at the National Museum of Scotland, and wax prints in Birmingham. By making this collection, Brighton hopes to create a national resource for people to borrow from and other institutions to use, and that's one of the reasons they got the money. Ruth Phillips has warned of the museum tendency to represent Africa as a set of distant and localised cultures, calling instead for collections which enable the representation of the cosmopolitanism of an Africa constructed as inclusive of the diaspora and just as mixed, hybrid and contemporary as the West. Museums both respond... Oh, I think we've got a better... Oh, no. Museums both respond and contribute to wider understandings of Africa in Britain, and by only displaying the late 19th or early 20th century objects, they are perpetuating a common stereotype of Africa as a place of inward-looking, unchanging tradition, playing into the modern versus traditional, civilised versus uncivilised dichotomy created to justify colonialism. One of the issues facing contemporary or recent African dress, which has contributed to it not being collected, is about where it's seen to belong within the museum system. Is it fashion or is it African? Can it be both? And Zachary Kingdon, who works at Liverpool Museum, has pointed out that objects that do not fit well into the museum classification system tend to be overlooked and forgotten because institutional practices favour working with objects that can be easily categorised according to ethnicity, geography, material, and not to collect objects with complex, personal, transnational narratives attached to them. And to just talk a bit more about this division between Africa and fashion, the V&A Museum, which is the British country's national collection of fashion, that's the responsibility they have, until 2009 was not collecting, was explicitly excluding African material from its collection. So the fashion and textile department collects, I am shoehorning in some PhD research here, but the fashion and textile department at the V&A, which is a very large department, focuses on European and American and British fashion, but then fashion from other parts of the world, in particular Asia, parts of Asia and so forth, are also collected by the museum. But until 2009, Africa was being explicitly excluded. And on the other hand, when Chris Spring, who has just retired as curator at the British Museum, first began collecting kangas, and the British Museum now has quite an important and interesting collection of kangas, there was resistance to that on the grounds that these objects were factory produced and often imported into Africa. But obviously that's true of a lot of the things that people actually wear. So there was this kind of idea that African collections or world art collections should have very traditional, often rural things, and fashion collections should have European things. And so there was nobody is really collecting an urban or a more cosmopolitan contemporary African experience. So African fashion remains viewed as costume, a term which, according to Karen Transberg Hansen, is usually related to ensembles coordinated for masquerades, theatrical parts, dress from distinct historical periods and native indigenous clothing styles. Costume implies traditional, authentic dress and is seen in direct opposition to the fast-changing modernity of fashion systems. The interpretation of dress in gallery displays and the dominance of 19th century dress in museum collections is both the result of and has contributed to perceptions of Africa and Africans as an unchanging and exotic other. The project was keen to question these old categories and therefore involved staff from both the fashion department and the Department of World Cultures, and the objects will be accessioned by both departments. Again, that doesn't sound like a big deal, but because of how museums are structured, that actually happens quite rarely. And now I'm going to hand over to Edith, who's going to talk a bit more about what we did. I'm just going to have that in the background.
Okay. Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here today sharing my experience of working on the Fashion in Africa project. So, as previously stated by Nicola, Brighton Museum sought to implement a collecting approach that was based upon collaborative working with source communities. This is where I came in. The objective set by Brighton Museum resulted in the creation of a panel of advisors, which included people from the BME Heritage Network within Brighton, external academics, museum and fashion specialists. And we were all supported by museum colleagues, Helen Mayers, Martin Pell, and Rachel Hemingway-Hurst. So that's a photograph of the group, shall we say, the Fashion in Africa panel. We met regularly throughout the duration of the project, every 4 to 6 weeks initially, and then every couple of months during busy periods, which was the months leading up and following the opening of the main exhibition, the Fashion Cities Africa exhibition. At the beginning of the project, the museum set out the context for the project and their approach of working with the source communities and, broadly speaking, the panel. Their ambitions of building capacity and cultural ownership within BME communities was very clearly expressed. I think it's important to mention here that prior to the program, prior to getting funding for the program, it was felt within the museum and externally within sort of BME community groups that, there wasn't a very good relationship, shall we say. Lots of individuals within BME community groups felt just distant from the museum and didn't go in. There was no connection at all. So their ambitions of building capacity and cultural ownership within BME communities was very clearly expressed. This was linked to the museum's ambition to widen their audience base and increase engagement with BME communities who were largely not engaging with the museum. Fashion in Africa would, it was hoped, serve a strong channel for strengthening the museum's relationship with BME communities, whilst also tapping into the cultural capital and creativity of these groups. This required a certain degree of generosity from the individuals and groups the museum intended to work with. I personally had some doubts about the project. I felt a sense of ownership about the subject matter, but at the same time, I felt distant from the museum, and this was something that was echoed by lots of other individuals as well who were invited to take part. Questions I asked myself, were they being genuine in their desire to be inclusive? Was my culture being done to me and not with me? Nevertheless, I decided I would take part and see it through. I think because of my background of working in the arts and working, you know, for the Arts Council, in my particular role as Diversity and Arts Relationship Manager, I think I've always believed that organisations and communities showing generosity towards each other is necessary for advancing inclusivity. You can't stop speaking, you can't stop engaging, basically. And it was clear to me that the museum had their hands stretched out to the community. And also, I needed my voice to be heard, given my background and my love of Nigerian fashion. My background isn't fashion, by the way, but if you know Nigerians, you know that it's such a dynamic area of Nigerian culture. So yes, it was a good opportunity, I felt, to be involved in something exciting. So panel meetings got off to a great start. We had a panel of people who were collectively experienced and passionate about the subject matter, invested in local communities and genuinely concerned about ensuring future engagement and collaboration between the museum and diverse communities. We were all very excited about the prospects of extending the museum's collection of African clothing and fashion items. In the first few meetings, we very quickly decided we needed to set parameters for the collection and came up with themes which we felt were important aspects to consider in the study of African textiles, as Nicola previously mentioned. I don't know if you've shown the slide. Or
that one.
So, yes. So we started out with those themes. The one on the left were sort of broad themes that we started out with. And this was just basically everyone on the panel, from their backgrounds, throwing out ideas and opinions about areas that we felt were important to consider in the collection of fashion items for the museum. So from these themes, the one on the left, emerged a list of more specific ideas which we felt would be good to reflect in the collection. And so you have the one on the right, which I think were the ones we discussed the most, I would say. And I think we were all clear that it's not, you know, it's not... you could add to this list, you could continue to add to this list, but these were the areas that we were able to bring to the table, shall we say, from our different backgrounds.
I think it's important to, as Edith's saying, that it's a very personal list. The interests that came up very much reflect, I think it's safe to say, the individual personalities,
yes,
and interests of the people involved.
Okay.
Yeah.
So with this broad thematic context in mind, the group also made considerations around the fact that our discussions were more focused on Anglophone countries, given the historical relationship between Britain and its previous colonies. We recognised the limitations of the museum's current collection, which were mainly from colonial British-speaking areas. Anglophone countries. That just didn't sound right. And the need to not replicate the collection at Brighton and other UK museums. So the new collection, we hoped, would be relevant to the city of Brighton and the nation as a whole. We also wanted to ensure that the existing collection, that our acquisitions would speak to the existing collection. We didn't, you know, we wanted some sort of continuation. And we agreed that we would not make any attempts at trying to represent the fashion practices of an entire continent, because, of course, it would be futile to do so. Fashion in the African diaspora and the practices which indicate reinvention, versatility in dress and fashion within African diasporic communities, we hoped would also be reflected in the collection. So basically we felt it was important to look at the fashion practices of the African diaspora in the UK. So, collecting activities. So at the end of that process, we ended up with a shopping list of sorts. And as Nicola said, we're still collecting. You know, collecting activity is ongoing, and that list has changed, because I think this was the list as of a year ago.
That was the list that was produced at the end
of the meetings.
So we had a long period of when we had meetings, and then we handed over. And then the museum sort of took all our discussions on what they thought we'd said and put it into this document, and said, "So you want us to find this stuff?" And we said, "Yeah, good luck." basically.
Yes.
But yes, it has changed. But also, there are some things we're still looking for. So do speak to us afterwards if you think you can help with anything.
So following the discussions at the previous meetings, the final stage of the group's activities was focused on coming up with this list, which we collectively felt should be considered by museum colleagues for researching and accessioning into the museum's collection. We all agreed that objects collected should be sourced and bought ethically, although we didn't discuss what that would mean in practice. Desirable items discussed for accessioning strongly reflected the themes we discussed at our earlier meetings. So if you can sort of see that those items sort of fall under these columns of indigenous textiles, fashion textiles, political, and just basically reflect those earlier themes we discussed at our meetings. So I think what I've learned from this experience is that there's value and strength gained by institutions, communities and individuals from working collaboratively in the way that the Fashion in Africa collection panel has. This was my experience, the synergy of a group with individual interests that together felt greater than the sum of its parts. I felt that this synergy created a drive as well as a heart and soul, which gave us that potential to connect to institutions, communities, and individuals in a way that we wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. We would have struggled to do this independently. Through this project, Brighton Museum has tapped into the cultural capital of the black and minority ethnic communities in Brighton and engaged with people who are invested and likely to go the extra mile. There now is a likelihood that seeds have been planted which would contribute strongly to keeping the new artefacts alive through engaging communities directly or formally on behalf of the museum and informally through personal engagement. And now Nicola's going to talk about some of the items we've collected.
Thanks. So this is the first. This was the first piece to be acquired by the project, and it was this long sleeve T-shirt, and it had belonged to Charles Makuya, and Makuya had been a member of Zimbabwe People's Revolutionary Army (ZIPRA) during Zimbabwe's struggle for independence in the 1970s. And he was sent for military training in Angola, where he was trained by Cuban and Soviet instructors. And the trainees at these camps were given white long-sleeve T-shirts by their Cuban trainers. And many individualized these by adding tie-dye designs using the dye and woolen blankets that they had also been given. So they would get the dye out of the blankets by immersing them in hot water and then use that dye to create these T-shirts. Following independence, ZIPRA members became a target for anti-dissident violence in Mugabe, Zimbabwe. And at this time, evidence of personal association with ZIPRA brought great risks. And most ZIPRA fighters disposed of items such as these T-shirts that might identify who they were. And this T-shirt in many ways exemplified what the project was trying to do. One of the things we were interested in and reflecting politics and political change in a very broad, taking quite a broad definition of politics. And we were interested as well specifically in political T-shirts, although obviously when we were talking about it, we didn't have anything like this in mind. We were thinking of kind of campaign T-shirts. So this T-shirt did in many ways exemplify what we were trying to do. It had a well-documented provenance and was associated with a named individual. It told a compelling personal story that unfolded in the context of wider national and international political processes, and it reflected several important themes in post-colonial African history. It also usefully demonstrates several factors that became central to the collecting process. as time went on, the panel member was asked, the panel, we were supposed to sort of hand over the list and then that was it. But as time went on, panel members were increasingly asked to do more and more of the collecting work because the museum didn't have the necessary connections, experience or knowledge to do that work. And Edith will be talking a bit more about her role in that in a minute. So this T-shirt was entirely dependent on the pre-existing connections and relationships of panel members. In this case, Joanne McGregor, who some of you may know, and she had met. She runs the Sussex Africa Centre at the University of Sussex, and she met Makuya as a result of another long-term research project she was doing. Secondly, serendipity. McGregor was not looking for items for the museum, but when the T-shirt arose in conversation, she was able to pursue it on behalf of the museum. And several items would come into the collection as a result of chance, some, for example, bought in local charity shops. For all the careful thought about what the panel wished to see in the museum, the end result will be as much a product of what could actually be found and purchased as it will be the aims and objectives of the panel and the museum. The purchase of this T-shirt also raised an uncomfortable issue for the project, which had often hung over discussions but perhaps not been talked about as explicitly as maybe it should. Should we be taking this material culture out of Africa and moving it to Europe? On the one hand, we wished to preserve these items, while on the other, we were making them inaccessible to the people who had created, owned and worn them. The museum felt at the time of purchase that this object would not be preserved in Zimbabwe due to ongoing political persecution associated with ZIPRA. But obviously political situations can change, and yet the removal of African objects to a European museum has historically been a final one. Although possibly that's changing. Museum protocols privilege the permanency of acquisitions and more flexible approaches which would permit the short-term custodianship of contested material until it can safely be returned, are still to be developed. And then I'm just going to talk about some of the other things we've collected a bit more informally and maybe some of the issues, talk about what the museum was trying to do by collecting these items and maybe some of the issues that arose before handing back to Edith. So this is Adore. The textile on the flat textile that you see, these kinds of textiles, which is indigo resist dyed, so starch is painted onto the cloth and then it's dipped in indigo, and then the bits that have starch on them stay white and the rest turns this very bright blue, and this is a hand painted cloth. And these cloths are quite well represented in British museums. So I was a bit like, I wouldn't bother buying them because there's loads of them around. But anyway, apparently it's not all up to me.
She disagrees.
So we don't always agree about everything. But what is much more unusual is to have garments made out of these objects. Mm. As I said, a lot of what museum collections have is flat textiles. Mm. And partly they're easier to store. And they're easier to use. So there are sometimes practical considerations why some things are collected and others not. But it's very unusual to actually have garments made up out of these objects. So that was something that the museum was very keen on, to have actual worn garments, often associated with people who, you know, we knew who wore them. We had names, maybe photographs, things like that. And then the other thing was to show pieces made on this one by the artist Nike Davies Okundai, who started a workshop and has sort of led to a resurgence of interest in these kinds of fabrics. And then the jumpsuit, the brightly coloured jumpsuit, the designer who made that's a contemporary Nigerian designer. And she's talked about being influenced by the patterns on the Adire. So this set of the objects is telling a more interesting story, and a story about change and different attitudes and different people taking different things from certain traditions and using them in different ways.
So I disagreed about Adire in particular, but not all the other. Because I like Adire.
I like it too, but like I say, there's a lot of it around. Anyway, we're not gonna rehash it.
No, we're not gonna
And then the other thing, and the fashion curator, and this is by the same designer, this is a beaded piece, the peacock piece, by the same designer as the previous one. And the fashion curator in particular, Martin Pearl, who was also involved in the project, was very keen that the collection documented the kind of the emergence of sort of high fashion associated with fashion weeks and international designers that's kind of been going on for the last, I don't know how long, but that's bit, he wanted very much to have that documented, to have a very clear sort of traditional fashion collection, if you see what I mean. And there were a number of people in the group as well, I think, who were very keen on kind of high-end fashion, while there were other people in the group who were more interested in kind of everyday dress. So these are the some of the political T-shirts that have gone into the collection. So we have, and in order to collect these, we've actually drawn on quite a lot of academic connections, academics who've been working in Africa for long periods of time, have helped us acquire those T-shirts, often through their personal collections. Also, social activists from Kenya, we don't have pictures of those T-shirts at the moment, who also have a personal collection of T-shirts and have let us have the duplicates. Politics was a very important theme to some people, and this is one of the ways in which politics are being represented in the collection. Another way that we collected was through myself and one of the curators on the project, Rachel Hemingway Hurst, who I think Edith mentioned earlier, travelled to Ghana. And we received funding from the Jonathan Ruffer Fund, which funds curatorial research, to make this trip of acquisitions. Because one of the problems, there are a number of problems with the HLF funding, but one of the problems with the HLF funding is that it does not cover international travel, which obviously, when this is your project, it is a huge problem. So international funding, either the international travel, either then needed to be funded additionally, or it was done when people happened to be in Africa anyway, collecting panel members and so forth. But then obviously that raises ethical problems about people using their personal resources for museum work and so forth. And this again, Kente cloth is quite well represented in UK museums, but it tends to all come from the Ashanti tradition, and so the museum was keen to do something slightly different and wanted to represent Ewe Kente from the Volta region of Ghana. So that was decided that would be the particular focus of this. And so this piece here, which shows the map of Ghana, was woven on commission for the museum. And again, additional funding had to be found to buy contemporary material, because if it's not 10 years old, the HLF won't pay for it. This cloth is incomplete, and when it is complete, he includes a strip at the top which includes his name, Ghetto Bobo, and his phone number. And the reason he does that is that actually a number of museum collections have his work, and it's quite often displayed without crediting a particular person. It is just shown as an example of weaving from this region. But actually this thing of creating maps and pictures is very much something that his workshop has developed. A lot of the ideas about collecting African material that persist in ways that you think that might surprise you. But yeah, still hung without his name. Won't be happening at Brighton. And then this was another contemporary piece, and again this happened just because I happened to be in Kenya. We have the collection has some other has some more traditional kangas, and in particular the kangas tend to we have tried to collect kangas that focus on issues to do with women and women's rights, and that's a reflection of one of the panel members who's an academic, legal academic specialising in women's legal issues. And she was very keen for that to happen. This is not a traditional kanga. This is an art piece by Kawira Murichie. And she's a young lesbian who lives and works in Nairobi. And she makes these kangas. She's doing one for every country. This one represents Kenya. She's still working on it. You can find out more at her website. And she's spoken very movingly about, because homosexuality is illegal, she's excluded from a lot of the kind of rituals with which kangas are associated, like wedding ceremonies and so forth. And so she was trying to kind of write gay people back into that history. What's particular? Hopefully Brighton Museum are going to buy some of the other countries, but at the moment they've just got this Kenyan one. It's one that represents Kenya. What's particularly nice about this for Brighton Museum is that one of the organisations it references various things. So it references a group called Ishtar MSM. It references the remix, the Art Attack remix of Macklemore's Same Love song, which some people might have heard of. And it also references the Nest Collective, and the Nest Collective are a collective based in Nairobi, and they work across a lot of media, but one of their representatives, Sunny Dolat, was very heavily involved in the previous exhibition, so this is a nice kind of full circle item for Brighton. And the quotes that you can see at the bottom, which were always a part of kangas, come from local members of the gay community in Kenya, in Nairobi particularly. Preview. I'm going to pass back to Edith, who's going to talk about collecting these lovely wedding outfits.
So I was tasked initially with collecting three sets of Ashoke outfits from the post-colonial period, specifically between 1960s to 2006 at the time, because this was 2016 and they had to be older than 10 years because of HLF stipulations. So Ashoke is southwest Nigerian textile, originally made by the Yorubas and worn by the Yorubas, but now worn widely by Nigerians, both in Nigeria and in diaspora. So the museum's specifications for me were quite flexible. I could collect from Nigeria, except of course without the travel funding, there's no way I could, you know, make it to Nigeria. So I was restricted. Or I could collect it from Nigerians in diaspora. And there were no travel costs included in my contract. I didn't have enough time to put in an application for travel funds, so I focused my efforts on looking for appropriate items to collect in the UK and the US as well. I have contacts in the US, so this was all basically drawing on my personal contacts, which seemed the most natural place to start from. I cast the net wide within my social circles, friends and family, communicating via email, WhatsApp, Facebook, and churches in the UK. The initial response I had was very positive and encouraging. I had a lot of responses. Many people offering support, but a lot of the items were, although they were very interesting, they weren't very suited to my brief. One guy offered me a set of filas, which is the men's hat. It would, you know, the gown on the right is an agbada and shokoto, and it's usually accompanied by a hat, which is called a fila. And this man had inherited
hundreds of hats from his father or grandfather, I can't remember, and he didn't know what to do with it. It would have been great, actually,
because we
probably would have had, you know, a good selection of textile examples through the years, but it just didn't fit. I could go back to him,
yeah,
see if it fits now. But that wasn't my brief. I was I couldn't follow through, and I think I checked with the museum at the time, and it was sort of, we just had to stay focused. You kind of have to, if you are going to, you know, spend the funding as you've sort of promised your group that you would. So the objects offered were often not complete sets or not of suitable quality, and, you know, items I couldn't get within the time frame set as well by the HLF. So some I had offers for items that fell outside of that time frame, which were just not suitable. Again, we couldn't pay for them. And some of them were also not appropriately contextualized with photographs or videos or just any history at all. And you know, that was something we were trying to get away from, because what you find is that a lot of the textile and fashion collections in museums are just, you know, great objects to have in there, but they're very poorly contextualized. You can't really tell anything about who's made them, where they've come from, etc., etc. So I narrowed my search base on the initial responses and began directly targeting individuals whose responses had provided me with a glimmer of hope, and it eventually narrowed down to two contacts in Brighton and a couple of contacts in London. Unfortunately, the one in London was another... Is it red herring?
Mm.
It just didn't, yeah. It was so exciting. It was meant to be a set, complete set of Ashoke from the 1960s. They said they were transporting it from a kitty, and it's such a big thing, you know. It's like, yes, from the 60s. Transported from Ekiti to Lagos, and then got someone to help bring it to the UK, and went down to London to see it. It wasn't from the 60s. It was full of lurex, which is a thread that was introduced into Ashoke weaving round about the late 70s and early 80s. So that was just a crushing moment for me. This is after, I think, a couple of months into the project, and yeah. So we carried on, I carried on. But the Brighton contacts, they were just amazing, really helpful. They'd lived in Brighton since the 90s, actually there were two contacts, one since the 90s and the other since the 80s, and mm-hmm. had complete sets, yes, of outfits. So one collection was from a couple, and it was from their wedding in 95, and they basically stored their wedding outfits in their loft. They're family friends, so I was actually pulling on, you know, this personal relationship and trust that we shared. So throughout the process, I felt I had to it felt like I had to balance my duties, the sense of duty I had to the museum, as well as, you know, not taking advantage of the friendship that I shared with these individuals. And I did this by ensuring that my communication between all parties was as clear as possible. And that information provided was backed up as much as possible with evidence where appropriate, and that the process was transparent. I think there was, for me as well, it was important to do that, because these are people I feel really closely connected to. And we talked about the ethics. We talked about being ethical, but we hadn't discussed it collectively as a group. And suddenly, in that moment, it just felt that this is, you know, it was just really crucial for me. They provided full access to their outfits, photos, videos from their wedding, which enabled the museum to assess the item's suitability for their collection. And based on advice sought from the museum's internal and external colleagues, we decided on what items to collect from this couple. And I'm not mentioning their name for a very specific reason, because they've asked to remain anonymous. They don't mind us using photos of their wedding from 95, but they prefer to not be named, basically. So the museum basically put in an offer on the basis of advice that they'd been given. And at this stage, the response from the couple, and actually in my own personal opinion, I felt that the museum had undervalued the items. So my sentiments were backed up by the owner's initial response. They basically said, "We're happy keeping our wedding outfits. It can stay in the loft." So, no thank you. So this was a very interesting point, going back and forth and liaising between the two parties. And for the first time, it felt like the sale could be in jeopardy. I made a case to the museum on the basis of their moral responsibility in setting appropriate values and standards within the sector in collecting post-colonial African fashion. They are really a Brighton museum, I think. There are not many museums doing what they're doing right now. And so it's important that they set good standards and that they set a good price mark, so that hopefully in future these items don't continue to be undervalued. So we had some discussions around that, and of course discussions with the couple around obviously their emotional connection to the objects and what they felt, you know, was the cultural value as well, and the age as well. It's from 95. Eventually we settled on prices that felt appropriate, thankfully, and began transferring the objects into the museum's collection, as well as capturing and converting the contextual images and video files. They had all the videos on VHS. They had videos from 5 different wedding events. And the great thing about this collection, actually, is that it also has helped to preserve a cultural practice which has now changed. So, the practices at the time of how they got married, they had several events, taking the letter to the bride's family, that was one event, the engagement. There were about 5 different events, 5 3-hour videos as well to transfer into digital format. And, you know, it feels great to actually, to have been, you know, to be able to collect that and preserve that. Can I carry on with the London contacts?
I think you've covered that, because that's the stuff about the... I think maybe move on to the display, okay. Unless you want to talk about your... I think you should talk about this one very quickly.
So the first outfit here is from their wedding, you know, the actual wedding night. They wore this at their wedding party. The man on the left, the groom, is wearing what you call a barrier, which is a loose gown, and if they're dancing, it just sort of opens up. It's quite beautiful. You can see it's full of lurex, gold lurex, which, they got married in 95, and this was probably at the height of the use of lurex in Ashoke weaving, so it's gold. And blue cotton and, you know, the synthetic threads. The next one, that's from their engagement. This is more sort of, it's full of lurex as well, but a bit more, you know, conservative, not so in your face, I guess. And again, the other thing we wanted to do with collecting the fashion, as Nicola said, is, you know, a lot of the past practices around collection tended to focus on just the textile. And what was great about this was we were actually also focusing on the fashion. So we collected items that were sewn and, you know, we were able to show how they were used. And that was really good. And this item was also collected, but it was outside of the HLF's time frame. So, but thankfully, he donated it to the museum with me pushing him. And again, on the basis of my personal relationship with him, he's my stepfather. And he was also able to, you know, through his connections to a church, was able to put word out at several services, you know. So this was very much based on connections, personal connections, connections to community groups. And what he's got on is an agbada, which is a different fashion style as well, men's fashion, Yoruba men's fashion. Textile is a classical Ashoke style, Sonyo, which is basically Ashoke sewn with the classical colours of beige and white. Is that me?
That's you.
Okay. And so following the collection activities, as we were coming to the end of this collection process, Brighton Museum was invited by the British Museum to take part in a programme called Object Journeys, whose ambition was to support community partners to research and explore their collection, that is the British Museum's collection. The programme draws on the knowledge of partner museums, community partners, and community partners in interpreting objects or reinterpreting objects through displays. And so basically we were invited to put on a display at Brighton Museum, and we could, you know, go into the British Museum's vaults, select items, and, you know, bring them back to Brighton. It was amazing. I was invited to join in this, and for me it felt like an excellent opportunity to extend the work that I'd been doing, and I decided to extend it backwards, because what we had was a good collection of items, post-colonial items. And so with the British Museum's partnership, we were able to look backwards. I don't know if we've put any photos.
So I put them all in there. So, let's see.
So the very earliest item we were able to get was from early 20th century. It was from 1927. We don't have a photo here. It was accessioned into the British Museum's collection in 1927, so it must have been much older. And, I mean, I just felt so excited about that. It was amazing. In the end, we were able to put together a display which spans about 100 years through 8 objects. And we're able to talk about different classical styles, but I think more importantly, we're able to look at these items and look at them in a way that's different from all the sort of stereotypes that Nicola talked about. So we talk about the international connections. We talk about the changing fashion practices, not just the textiles. You know, we talk about the individuals who made these items where possible. We talk about the culture as well, that these textiles and fashion practices are connected to. And also through the British Museum's funding, we were able to then also purchase a present-day item, which is this one that you see behind me.
The woman's outfit.
Yeah, the woman's outfit, which we commissioned for this display, actually, and accessioned into Brighton Museum's collection early this year, just before the display opened. And I think I'll close there. Do you want to say something?
I just want to say that this display, curated by Edith, is on until the 31st of March next year, 2019. And alongside it is this. Seppo was also part of the collecting panel, and he did a similar project. But his is called Township Journeys, and it's based around South African material. That's also on. And then another strand we haven't touched on at all, but they have also been collecting photography alongside the garments. And this display has been curated by Rachel Hemingway Hurst, who again was mentioned earlier. And that's studio photography from Africa, and that's also on until 31st of March. So, trip to the seaside. So just to highlight those, that those are available.
Thank you.
Thank you.